Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow. And
hey, hey, you're listening to Ear Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So today we are talking about a product called Jell-O. And, you know, this is a food that we're all very familiar with, I would imagine. And it's not something I've ever thought too much about, written too much about. I bet it's not something we talk about too much on Heritage Radio Network and in many discussions about the new food movement or local food and so forth. But, you know, it is a part of our lives. And reading this book that I'm holding right now has brought back just a wave of nostalgia for all things Jell-O. And in fact, a few years ago, I was invited to a potluck where we were tasked with making vintage recipes. And I pulled up the most, what I thought was the most preposterous sounding recipe, and it was this towering mold of Jell-O stacked in layers with things like salmon and canned salmon, that is, and cucumber suspended in the clear lemon Jell-O and parsley, suspended in another layer. And it was just the most crazy thing. But also it was just crazy as a feat of human or edible accomplishment, as a feat of, I felt quite accomplished having made it. So, you know, Jell-O is a part of our lives. And I'm really excited to be telling you about this book that I've really been telling everyone about this book, I think, all summer and all fall. It is an amazing memoir. It is called Jell-O Girls, A Family History. The author is Allie Rowbottom, and she joins us on the phone right now. Hi, Allie.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining, and congrats on your memoir. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So, Allie, you are a PhD in creative writing. You've gotten a BA and MFA before that in writing. Your fiction has, and also, you know, nonfiction has garnered many prizes and been published in the Best American Essays series and Tin House and so forth. So you're an incredible writer, and I got goosebumps reading this book. But I don't know if everyone who's an incredible writer also has such an incredible family story to write about. So this is quite a story. So tell me a little bit about your connection to Jell-O, or your family's connection.
Sure. I mean, first of all, thank you. That's so kind. And I do feel like, as a writer, very lucky to have this story. You know, I think people ask me why I chose to write this book. It's like my first book. And my answer is always like, how could I not? It's like, it was right there in front of me asking to be written. So my family's connection to Jell-O is a little bit tangential, but also, you know, definitely a vivid presence in especially my mother's life. My great-great-great uncle, by marriage, bought the patent from its inventor in 1899, mm-hmm. and went on to make the company sort of what it is we think of when we think of Jell-O today. It was sold in the 1920s to General Foods, which has since become Kraft. And I will say, like, the Jell-O company originated in a small town in upstate New York called Leroy, where my mother's side of the family was from, but has since moved to Dover, Delaware. So, you know, the connection is historical and mythologized and in some ways distant. But in my mother's life, it was quite a presence, not only through the money that she inherited, but also just sort of through the metaphor of Jell-O itself and the way it kept cropping up sort of ironically in her life.
Yeah. And so, okay, so your your family inherited, or they sold Jell-O to General Foods for $67 million back in the 20s.
That's correct. Yeah.
So you guys are Jell-O heirs to this.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
There's, I will say, like, it's an interesting family, and I think this happens a lot in every family, not only families with a lot of wealth, but are in a lot of families. But there are many Jell-O heirs out there. It's sort of this, like, strange, diffuse community. In as much as, you know, Order, who bought the patent, had many children, and they sort of split off and fragmented. So there's a lot of people with Jell-O stories out there, which is also fascinating in and
that
of itself.
That is really neat.
Yeah, my mother's family stayed very close to Leroy and was very connected to Edith Woodward, who became the matriarch of the Jell-O family. So that's who we inherited our money from and sort of the Jell-O lore from as well.
Right. So your story, this book, actually, it sounds like it began with your mother's writing. She was always documenting and writing about her family history. But it has to do with the women in your family. So, you know, hence the title Jell-O Girls. And I think it's interesting. You start out by saying that, you know, there's this known curse that people would talk about, the Jell-O curse. But the men in the family thought it was confined to the men. So, like, you know, money equals headache equals, you know, responsibility equals stock markets dropping. And then, you know, there was an uncle who was, you know, affected by the Great Depression and jumped off like, you know, many men of a building when the stock market crashed. So if you don't mind, I would love to read actually a little bit from the introduction where you explain that. You write, "The curse. When my mother was a child, it was used to explain all manner of family misfortune, death, alcoholism, wealth, and the existential boredom it brought with it. It was, she was told, confined to men, and therefore nothing for her to worry about. All she had to do was stay cute, stay pretty, stay silent. Later, she understood these admonitions were the curse. The curse wasn't confined to men. It came from them, from the social structure predicated on their power. The curse was a silence impressed upon her, her mother before her, and countless women before them. The curse was the sickness that silence becomes when swallowed, lumps of unspoken words ticking like bombs." So that's a really, really fascinating setup. And, you know, I don't want to give away all the things that happened to all the women in the book. And I guess I gave away that uncle's fate, but
spoiler.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because we do talk a lot about, you know, family curse and you know, the curse of money and the corruption of power and so forth. But this is a very different type of curse. And I think it's interesting that you weave in sort of the social history of our country along with your family history and how Jell-O is there along every step of the way with women's roles. Okay, let's start off a little bit about talking about the origins of Jell-O. So I didn't actually know that it went back so long in Europe. People ate gelatin desserts.
Sure. And I mean, in as much as, like, sort of connected to this idea of the curse is the curse of great wealth and privilege, which I hope that my book sufficiently debunks. Jell-O was originally very much confined to nobility and to wealthy people, particularly because it was so, I mean, it wasn't known as Jell-O then, it was just gelatin.
Right.
And it was so labor intensive, you know, it required hours of preparation from boiling bones and hides to skimming to, you know, just all.
Hooves. Yeah.
Yeah. This long process that fell to servants really to perform. And then not only that, but the molding of elaborate towers like the ones you made. So I think like Jell-O, the product, was so revolutionary because it democratized this food item that had previously been confined to wealthy classes.
Right. So the industrialized version of this in powder form, the unflavored.
Exactly.
Yeah. Got it.
And not only that, but it then appealed to the sort of scientific sensibilities of certain periods of time in American history where, you know, convenience foods were privileged, and the idea of a natural product was the idea of sort of a dirty product or something that we wouldn't want to ingest, whereas obviously now the pendulum is swinging and people are much more interested in whole and natural foods.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how Jell-O was marketed throughout the ages of, you know, being easy for everyone to make. A child could make it. You even write some anecdotes about how early Jell-O salesmen would go to Ellis Island and treat these immigrants right off the ship to a Jell-O in a mold and say like, "Hey, welcome to America."
So
even
yeah,
you can make it.
Yeah, exactly. Jell-O was actually served on ships headed to America, and then when immigrants disembarked, they were given their own metal mold. And like, you can Google it; it's kind of amazing. There's some really old, original metal molds that you can see online, the likes of which were handed to people as they got off boats and made their way onto American soil.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And you mentioned, you know, after Second World War, you know, Jell-O was playing this important role. Sorry, in shaping our attitudes on food. No pun intended, actually pun intended, because you write that, you know, it was common to see Jell-O shaped into a mold of like, it wasn't uncommon to see chicken or tuna disguised by mayo, congealed with Jell-O, then shaped into the specter of the animal from which it originated. So consumers didn't want the actual food. They wanted something that was somehow cleaner and, but not, you know, the animal itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're still sort of in that moment, you know, in terms of like packaged meats, I suppose, but like this is just like a whole other level. It was a simulation rather than a real
mm-hmm. not
food
a fruit.
Item. And I think,
it's certainly not a fruit.
It speaks a lot to where we were as a country at that particular point in time, which was that we were, you know, immersing ourselves in progress and technology and convenience.
Mm-hmm. And before then, too, around the turn of the century, Jell-O was associated with salads. Somebody made the first sort of coleslaw suspended in Jell-O, and that really took off from there. But I think it's interesting you write that there's a correlation of women and salads. So women are dainty and decorative, and so are salads. So it became this sort of, you know, the production, you write, the production of a salad too beautiful to eat was the epitome of success for modern domestic scientists and contributed to the notion that women's attitude or appetites were as dainty as the desserts and the salads and desserts that they labored over. So there's this immediate, like, female realm when it came to Jell-O.
Absolutely. And I think in terms of like specifically the correlation between women and salads, you know, sometimes it feels like it persists today in some ways.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it can really be traced back to that old Aristotelian idea of men being associated with sort of the rational mind and women being associated with the natural world and embodiment. And if salads are this food item that is like, at least, you know, a green salad is coming from the earth. It's its leaves, its foliage. I think, you know, that that association is all the more pressing. But, you know, Jell-O salads anyway is sort of were tasked with reining in and confining the fruits of the earth by literally molding them and encapsulating them. So right. It was almost this idea or metaphor for femininity reined in and controlled.
And being very ornate too, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, and decorative and pleasant and not challenging.
I'm curious, why did the Jell-O, it sounds like Jell-O really transformed salads throughout the early 1900s and mid-1900s in America. How did that fall out of favor?
You know, I think that it was mostly had to do with sort of a push back towards more natural foods. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, I say in the book, like, in the 1960s, there was more of that sort of movement coming in, and it continued into the 70s, not to mention the fact that women were beginning to you know, maybe leave their marriages and join the workforce more, and so they had less time right. to labor over elaborate salad molds. And Jell-O's marketing reflected that they were aware of this change, and they were sort of struggled for a bit and ultimately wound up focusing more on kids and on diet food.
Diet food, yeah. There's that short-lived, what was it called? The sugar-free saccharin?
Dezerta.
Dezerta. Dezerta, which was the diet, I guess, Jell-O. But you write about this interesting ad campaign, an unfortunate ad campaign in the 70s that tried to inspire women to make Jell-O through various different characters. There was one woman who was like, oh, I made Jell-O because I bought this expensive fur coat. So here you go, to their wife or to the husband.
Yeah, they're sort of cringe-inducing now. People can Google them and find them quite easily. But the images are shot as if from the perspective of a man looking down on a woman, and she's sort of gazing up at him guiltily with all manner of excuses as to what she's done wrong,
right.
such as backing the car to the driveway incorrectly or buying a fur coat. And in one, she's actually asking to get a job and go back to work.
Ooh.
So she's offering him a Jell-O as a sort of consolation prize as she asks permission to leave the house and the sphere of the kitchen.
Oh, my goodness. So those tanked. Those kind of tanked, though, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it does seem so. At that point in time, Jell-O was sort of struggling to find its footing with its primary audience, which was women.
And it's so interesting that it seems that your mother and your grandmother felt confined to their roles of the times, you know, to just be pretty. You know, don't speak too much and, you know, just be this dainty, ornate wallflower, essentially, that, you know, some of these ornate Jell-O molds, it's too pretty, literally, to eat, it seems. So I think that it's amazing how you weave in the stories of and the feelings and the reflection of the times with your family history in this book. And it made me wonder, you know, is marketing, is this advertising, you know, a reflection of the values, or does it help to really enforce them, the values of, you know, the roles of women at the time?
I kind of think the latter. I think both. But I do think that, you know, advertising is always a reinforcement of what's going on culturally, and oftentimes that's detrimental to women. And I do think that, like, you know, it's also just a reflection and it's a mirror, but in terms of affecting change, I do think that, like, advertising has some responsibility to sort of lead the way and to create more positive imagery. Do I think that, you know, companies will, from Jell-O to anything else, will necessarily do that? No.
Yeah.
I think consumers have to demand it, but I do think that it is both a reflection and a reinforcement.
It sounds like your mother was a bit of a feminist, though, and she broke the mold, if you will. that and your grandmother, it sounds like she would have liked to have not lived, you know, this life, this expected life of raising kids and, you know, being the perfect housewife and so forth. So I want to talk a lot more about those stories right after a quick little commercial break, and we'll be right back.
Sounds good. If I come into a party hitting reps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting reps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting reps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist. If I come into a party hitting reps like this, all you superficial rappers will cease to exist.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market, whatever makes you whole.
All right, we're back chatting more with Allie Rowbottom. She's the author of Jello Girls, A Family History, a harrowing memoir. And Allie, you still there?
I am. I can hear some music, however.
Oh, okay. Let's turn that down. How's it now?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah, so we were just talking about the women throughout this book, the characters and your family story. And you know, tell me a little bit about your mom's journey, because you open with very touching scenes where you're serving her Jello, ironically, as her last meals in the hospital. But her connection to Jello, she kind of tried to stay away from it a bit, didn't she?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so. My mother grew up in Leroy, New York. She was born in Peru, but grew up in Leroy, New York. Which was the birthplace of Jell-O, and a town that was and still is very invested in that label and that identity. And
that's,
I think
so
she just felt very, she felt very stifled by it and very, for lack of a better word, silenced by the culture of the town. And she saw that as connected to Jell-O, but also just connected to, later she would see it as sort of connected to patriarchy and patriarchal culture. Mm-hmm. So she did a lot to get away from that. You know, she struggled as a teenager. Her own mother died when she was just 14, and that was really hard for her. So she did everything she could, I think, to sort of remove herself from the place where her mother had fallen ill, and also the place where she felt, my mother felt sort of like an outsider. Like, she felt different. She felt like she was an artist in a town that was not supportive of that. And she did a lot to get out and create a career for herself that was something other than what she had been raised to do.
Yeah. And she, so she became an artist, but you write that she was always sort of a little bit reluctant to sort of own her, accomplishments, you know, to teach. Yeah. She would rather take classes than teach because she felt like, you know, because of her fortune, she didn't really have to work and she didn't have to prove that she could make it on her own through her work. So it was a bit of a curse in that sense.
Yeah, I think that was one of the sort of biggest, I don't want to say regrets, but just sort of like challenges of her life was, you know, despite her ideals and her feminism to own her accomplishments and her voice and to value them the way that other people sort of encouraged her to.
That's
I say in the book that she just gave away her work sort of compulsively and then felt bad for having done so, but she would have felt bad for having accepted money for it as well.
Right.
It was just the sort of endless cycle of feeling bad about herself for one reason or another.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a type of curse that comes from the wealth and, you know, that is shared by, it sounds like, maybe even the men in the family, you know. So,
sure.
But it's different all the same. So how do you feel, I'm curious, Allie, about your Jell-O, I guess, family legacy and, you know, writing about it today? And did you grow up eating it? How do you feel?
I grew up sort of you know, removed from Jell-O in as much as, like, my mom really didn't make it. It was sort of like a, I didn't understand really the story of how, you know, our family's connection, though she would tell it to me. So it really wasn't until much later in my life that I understood the connection fully, and sort of understood the financial connection. I will say that, like, having, you know, I've lost my mother and having inherited her slice of the Jell-O pie, I will say that it really feels like it's much more connected to her, to me, than it does to Jell-O. Like, I know she felt that the fortune was somehow connected to this Jell-O legacy, but for me, it's just connected to her.
To her. So, Mary,
which is nice. Yeah. I'm happy about that.
Oh, that's good. So your mother, Mary is her name, began writing, and she wanted to tell her story. She wanted to finally speak up and really put this family history out there. Tell me about that, and how did you use her work in order to write this book?
So my mom started a memoir when I was about six, and it was following an experience that she had in which she spent several years getting ill, sort of violently ill around her period every month, and not getting a diagnosis that was satisfying to her from the doctors that she consulted. And sort of the long short of it was, after years of suffering, an exploratory surgery showed that she had a rare form of cancer, and that it, you know, was progressing quite quickly. It was and needed to be cut out immediately, lest she die. And that experience, I think, really prompted her to want to tell her story, the story of her mother before her, and just sort of the story of having been a woman in the world combating these forces that were sort of telling her to quiet down, or that she was crazy when she was voicing real concerns about any number of things.
Right.
So she began that memoir, and it chronicled her childhood. It also chronicled some years that she spent at the Austin Rigg Center, which is a psychiatric hospital in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, sort of during the 60s. And I think she originally envisioned the book to be sort of like a Girl Interrupted type memoir. But ultimately, it just, no matter how many times she redrafted or rewrote or tried a different angle, the book just wasn't coming together. And, you know, eventually she passed it to me because she was becoming too sick to continue. And so I sort of took up the mantle and thought, let me see if I can try my hand at this.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I used her source material quite closely when I was first drafting the book. And, you know, then it became my own thing as well.
Oh, that is wonderful. Do you think your mom would have been proud of the final result?
Yes.
That is really great. And, you know, it sounds like a long labor of I want to say love, but it's also, you know, when you're describing the illnesses she suffered from, and the sort of denial of the actual medical reason, or, you know, or unknown reason at the time, people didn't know what it was. But there was that sense that, you know, women are too hysterical. Do you think that this happens? This is still recurring in medical science today with regards to women's diagnoses?
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. I think there's more of sort of an understanding of the historical roots of that tendency, you know, to sort of tell women that they're crazy instead of taking them seriously. But I think it still happens.
Yeah.
It's happened to me. I think a lot of women have stories like this, and I definitely think it still happens.
Yeah. You write this book at a time where we are experiencing a national sort of reckoning, if you will, or the Me Too movement. And I think it's even more ironic than ever that, you know, to a lot of people, when they hear Jell-O, they think of Bill Cosby.
And yeah.
I mean, is that a curse of Jell-O?
He fits in this sort of weird and troubling, especially now, way. He's part of the history, yeah.
And I didn't realize that he was, like, the longest-running celebrity and brand contractual
spokesman, yeah.
Partnership, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's just wild. You can't pick a better sort of, or worse, I should say.
It's especially troubling to go back and sort of look at the commercials now with sort of a fresh perspective. They are quite ominous.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope this book will add in light of the Me Too movement, and to add to the conversation of the Me Too movement, if any?
You know, I think one of the imperatives of, you know, Me Too and certainly of this book is to speak, I suppose, and to, you know, to speak about one's trauma, whether it be, you know, specific to their gender or not. I think that, you know, I don't think that speaking is the only way to express one's trauma or to process it, but I do think that when it comes especially to women's experiences over time, sharing, you know, one story and listening and bearing witness to others' stories, as is sort of the origin of the Me Too movement, is a really good place to start. And I hope this book just sort of serves as a call to arms and a reassurance that it's safe to do so.
Yeah. And, of course, you couldn't have, you know, when you were, I imagine when you started to write this book, you couldn't have imagined that the Me Too movement would have happened. So did it fuel, did it, I don't know, change the way you approached the, writing this book at all?
Well, I had finished by the time Me Too had started coming around. I do think, though, like, if you had told me while I was writing the book that Me Too would become a thing, I would have, I don't think I would have done anything different necessarily, but I do think that, you know, I would have said that it was, you know, only a matter of time anyways. Like, I don't think that I wrote this book not expecting some kind of uprising
tie
at some
in.
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is a really powerful book, regardless of the time that we are living in. And I just think it's so cool how you were able to tell so many different stories. I mean, we didn't even get to all of them. There was this mysterious illness in Leroy that you started out with, a very, very, very tantalizing beginning. And just so many sort of gripping aha moments throughout. So I really hope that everyone gets their hand on this wonderful book. And, well, I guess that's about all the time we have right now. But thank you so much, Ali, for joining us.
Thank you, Kathy. And, you know, thank you so much.
Yeah. And anyone who's interested in food history, female history, feminine politics, and or just reading a really great memoir, hope you pick up this book. And thanks, everyone, at Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.